Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, August 5th, 1998. In the fireside room this afternoon is the presenter Chuck Schaefer. Today's session number is 98-2, and it is titled Reassessing the Impact of the Missionary Enterprise on Africa. Let's listen in.
What I'm going to talk about is reassessing the impact of missionary enterprise on Africa. But I was wondering, just to get the thing going, how many of you have been missionaries or are children of missionaries? You have been a missionary. Where was that?
After we graduated from PLU, Pam and I, my wife and I, were taught English in Japan for 3 years.
Oh, good. Yeah. Very good.
I will not claim the name missionary because I don't like it.
Okay.
But I worked for 8 years in the West Indies.
In the West Indies?
Uh-huh.
Whereabouts?
In the Bahamas.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Very good.
But I never saw myself as a missionary.
It's a word that is problematic to many. And I know that sort of reassessing the whole sort of enterprise, the missionary enterprise at DGM, about 2 years ago, we started out with the very basis. Well, what should we call these folks if we don't call them missionaries? And I'm not sure we settled on anything particularly different, but I understand what you're
well,
saying.
Well, I worked, the church was self-supporting mm-hmm. in that area, and mm-hmm. I worked, and I was part of it.
Yeah.
I was not sent out by anybody.
Yeah. I guess what I'd like to do is begin the talk a little bit by asking a question. What was the impact of Western missionaries on Africa or anywhere else in your conception? What has been the impact of missionaries on Japan or
kind of a mixed bag? I mean, there have been probably some definite benefits brought to certain cultures, but I think some things that were perhaps detrimental in maybe undermining an existing culture. Mm-hmm. You know, when there was an attitude that the Western culture was superior, so it was going to supplant what's already there.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess I associate with
colonialism.
Mm-hmm.
You were going to mention the same thing, that missionaries are agents of colonialism.
Part parcel
of them. Yeah. Any other sort of notions, preconceptions, ideas that you have about missionaries? I think you're sort of right down. I mean, you're expressing many of the conceptions that many people have had for over 100 years. And certainly the whole idea that missionaries are part of the colonial imperialist enterprise is hard to break. And certainly it is there. I think there is somewhat of a mixed record, and essentially when you're looking at the missionary enterprise, or heretofore when we've been looking at the missionary enterprise, it seems to sort of fall into two groups. Those who believe that missionaries were agents of colonialism and imperialism, and on the other hand, sort of apologists for proselytization, apologists for the missionary enterprise, who are able to overlook some of the cultural aspects of missionaries and the influence of mission stations on a local village or whatnot, and are just there with sort of the preconception that the end-all and be-all is saving souls. My own experience, just sort of an aside, so that you sort of know what biases I'm bringing to this panel. My own upbringing has a lot to do with missionaries. My folks were missionaries in Ethiopia. I was grew up there for about almost 10 years, and then we went to Lebanon, and then after that to Switzerland. Following that, my folks went back out to the missionary to the mission field in Hong Kong. My grandparents had been missionaries in India, and so in our family, there's I guess one can express it that the family has this legacy of missionary enterprise, and we have been rather defensive about it. I'm speaking we in terms of the family, of my grandparents and parents. I had a rude awakening when I went to the University of Chicago and was going to study Africa. I thought, well, maybe the easiest thing for me to do would be to write a dissertation on missions. And so I started looking and pursuing that aspect, and then took a number of classes in anthropology, and was sort of dumbstruck at the vehemence of the condemnation of the missionary, and also the thought that had gone into these condemnations of the missionary enterprise. And so I quickly or rapidly gave up that project and became an economic historian, thinking that it was maybe safer at least in my late 20s and early 30s to think about things that were not so close to home, that perhaps weren't so confrontational, both for me emotionally and for my family, and so forth and so on. And it's only been since graduation, since being out in Ethiopia, working with a development agency during the famine of 85-86, and then having been in other NGO efforts in both in Ethiopia and elsewhere, that I've come back to appreciate some of the things that missions bring to countries like Ethiopia or anywhere else in Africa. So, sort of fortuitously, about 3 years ago, I was elected to the Division for Global Mission of the ELCA. And so I bring this long history of missions, but I also bring, I think, a sensitivity to the fact that people have articulated in a myriad of ways a condemnation of missionaries and an association with missionaries as agents of colonialism and imperialism. So that's sort of my own bias. The biases that I'm bringing to this session. But what I'd like to do is essentially talk a little bit about the missionaries as agents of colonialism and imperialism. And as we have sort of spoken at the very beginning here, it's a widespread, commonly articulated association. And this goes way back to David Livingston. Back in, what was it, 18, I think it must have been in about the 1840s, he was traveling through East Africa in Nyasa land. He was seeing what human harm the slave trade did to Africans. This was the Omani slave trade. That was, these caravans were setting out from Zanzibar, going into the interior of Africa, taking many, many slaves, putting them in chain gangs, and bringing them to the coast. And he was there in the middle of Africa, witnessing this, writing about it, and sending his letters back to England. This actually was after the English had abolished slavery and were taking efforts to stem the slave trade in all of Africa. But I think what was unique about what he was seeing was that he was seeing the inhumanity of the slave trade in the interior. You know, the English and Americans and everybody else had participated in it, but we had essentially had these coastal forts. And so we really didn't see what was going on in the collection and transportation of slaves from the interior to the coast. And what does Livingston do? In one very, very famous passage, he sends out a plea to the English government and to Christians in all of England and all of Europe, asking them, pleading for them to bring Christianity, commerce, and civilization to Africa. The three C's. So right from the beginning, there is this linkage between the colonial administration and church mission boards who are going into Africa. Another example of this close association, Frederick Lugard, who was essentially the author and implementer of the British colonial policy of indirect rule, which was the most effective colonial policy that the British ever invented. He used missionaries in this way. What the British the Foreign Office and the Colonial Office in Great Britain were very penurial. They didn't really want to spend much on their colonies in Africa. And indirect rule was predicated on the assumption that what you should do is let local hierarchical political social structures exist, and essentially create an umbrella over them. But what does this mean? This worked incredibly well in Niger and in northern Nigeria, where you had Islamic civilizations with a nice hierarchical structure where the British colonial administrator could easily identify who was on top. Then you just set your sort of umbrella over that and co-opt that person into your system, and that works very, very fine. But in much of Africa, they have what various African sociologists or Africanist sociologists call African democracy. Not that innovative a name, but it's an attempt to try to make understandable the kind of political structure that existed at the local level, in which Africans tried to decide issues through consensus. And so everyone had a say, or at least kinship lines had a mechanism to select someone who would represent their kinship line at this sort of table in which major decisions were discussed. The British didn't like this, because who is on top? You can't really find that person. And so what they would do is they would essentially arbitrarily create hierarchical structures from those Africans who had been baptized, who had been who were converts, who were mission converts, and who sort of knew what a hierarchical structure was all about. Missions were very hierarchical. You had the pastor or the priest on top. You had various other missionaries below them, maybe a Bible translator or something below them, but it was very hierarchical. And converts to Christianity were sort of educated in this concept of a hierarchical structure. And Lugard simply said, what we need to do to develop and implement indirect rule in places where there is no hierarchical structure is go to the missions, find those people who have converted, and place them in positions of authority. You can imagine why Africans have so vehemently condemned the missionary enterprise and seen it as part and parcel of imperialism, colonialism, at least on the British front. in the French colonial administration in French West Africa was even more blatant about that. Oftentimes, the French colonial administration and the French Catholic Church work hand in hand. The priests would inform the district administrator. They would carry out censuses. This is an enormously crucial thing. To carry out a census means that you know who is there, which gives the administrator the possibility to go in and tax and recruit, to force these people into corvée labor for the colonial administration. So Aimé César, Frantz Fanon, a host of other sort of Francophone Africans can't even distinguish between the two. They seem as part and parcel of the same. And certainly throughout Africa, you have numerous other sort of examples of missionaries working in cahoots with colonial administrators. Now, you have some apologists for the missionary enterprise. And what the apologists tend to do is find particularities. They find an individual, they find sort of a function that seems to have redeeming qualities, and they boost that up and try to maybe wash over some of the blemishes of the missionary enterprise. For example, an American who worked amongst the Kamba in Kenya. He came out in 1903. He quickly learned Kamba. He translated the Old Testament. He was considered a real leader. He was very sympathetic, and he took the African position on numerous occasions against the British colonial enterprise. In fact, in one celebrated instance, this was during World War I, where the British in Kenya were trying to raise an army to fight the Germans in Tanganyika, just south of them. They had to go into various areas and recruit African laborers to carry their stuff, to do all the labor required to support an army. And when they came into the Kamba area, George Rode, this American missionary, stood in front of the British colonel and said, "No, you simply cannot do this. You cannot come in here and unlawfully recruit these people into this army. They are not part of the colonial administration." At that time, there was some problems with border delineation, and there were some questions about whether it was truly part of Kenya or not. And so he just stood up and confronted the Kenyan or the British authorities, and was able to save the Kamba from arbitrary recruitment into the war effort. Many other examples like this exist. I'm sure any of you who have been out on the mission fields can find 5 or 6 examples. But the problem with this is that it deals with particularities, and you get some good apples and you get some bad apples. And sure, you can sort of elevate those folks who were good apples and say they did a fine job. On the other hand, what about all of those whose motives weren't pure or something so forth. But I think what has interested me in the last year to year and a half is to find that Africans are now going back into their histories and reassessing the 20th century. Hitherto, African historiography has essentially looked at the imperialism and colonialism as a blight on their histories, and that carried the day. Throughout the 60s after independence, through the 70s and the 80s. But African historiography has sort of gone in a couple phases. There was Afro-optimism, which was that part, that sort of expression of enormous optimism that existed in the 60s and early 70s after independence. And then when kleptocracy came into being, when everybody seemed to be, when there's dictators seemed to be just arising almost everywhere, there was a real sense of pessimism. And there was a real attempt to try to find scapegoats. Well, why aren't we developing as we thought we would when we were when we achieved independence? And in that climate also, there was an attempt to try to find scapegoats within the missionary enterprise. But what is sort of interesting about African studies right now is that African studies has come around and is in a phase called Afro-realism right now, African realism right now. And people are going back and trying to figure out, okay, we know that change has happened. We know that the agents of this new world order are so invasive that we can't get away from them. Therefore, let's parse out all of the different enterprises and try to figure out what they contribute or how they contributed to our political consciousness today. And so, amongst these, and this is sort of the core of what I'd like to talk about today, are some Africans who have begun to look at the linguistic legacy of Bible translators on the formation of political consciousness in Africa. And particularly, two come to mind, or at least I know of two, that I've been sort of following. One is John Karanja, and the other is Paul Malandi, and both of them are Kenyan. Paul Malandi deals with the Kamba, John Karanja deals with the Kikuyu, who are up there, the name of the Kikuyu are up there. Let me just sort of talk a little bit about the Kikuyu. The Kikuyu are the largest tribe in Kenya. Jomo Kenyatta was the leader of Kenya from independence, which I think was in 1963-64, until the late 70s when he died, and Daniel Arap Moi has taken over. But in this phase, in this early phase, Jomo Kenyatta had enormous amount of influence, and the Kikuyu were sort of at the forefront of the articulation of Kenyan political consciousness. Now, the Kikuyu, as I said, are the largest group. They live up in the highlands of Kenya, north of Nairobi. It's a wonderful area. About 6,000 feet elevation. The temperature never goes above 90, never goes below maybe around 50. It's green, it's verdant, it's beautiful. The British, when they came to this area, they said, oh boy, let's make this a settler colony. And so instead of just sort of using African labor for exploitation, what they wanted to do was rid the land of Africans and use it for plantations, out of Africa, with Isaac Dennison as an example of that environment. They go there, they plant their tea and their coffee, and they make these wonderful plantations. And so the Kikuyu were always in opposition with the British settlers. They wanted their nice fertile land. The British also wanted it. Well, what happens? Where does Paul Karanja begin his story? He begins his story in about 1903, when American missionaries go out to this area and they begin to translate the Bible. The translation takes an enormously long time. It begins in 1903. The New Testament is finally completed in 1926. The Old Testament is completed in 1941, but then they run out of money. So they only have an initial publication of maybe 1,000, 2,000 issues, and they have to wait until after World War II to publish most of the rest of the volumes of the Old Testament. So we're dealing with a pretty recent history. Now, what took place? What linguistically did these missionaries, Western missionary Bible translators, give to the Kikuyu? I think Karanga says three things. One, the Kikuyu alphabet was formalized by these Bible translators. In many different languages, you need various symbols, glottal stops or something, to depict the different kinds of, pronunciations that they have. And although Kikuyu had been translated earlier, it was formalized in this period. Two, it standardized the Kikuyu language, and it gave Kikuyu a lexicon, a formalized lexicon that contributed, or that radically, let me put it this way, that radically changed the language. It gave it much, but it also withdrew the variety of other sort of vernaculars that were present amongst the Kikuyu in maybe different villages or different regions of their lands. And third, the Bible translation dramatically changed the Kikuyu language, and it made it far more univocal. What do I mean by that? I mean the meaning of the words were specified in non-literate cultures. Most non-literate cultures seem to appreciate and almost have an affinity for ambiguity. That is, you're telling a story, you don't quite know what it means. I mean, this is maybe this sort of feeds into the Bible study. The Old Testament was an oral tradition handed down, and there's a lot of ambiguity in the Old Testament. Well, many sort of non-literate cultures have, their languages are infused with this ambiguity, and they seem to revel in it. But here you have Western sort of Bible translators who are trying to develop a dictionary, and they want precise definitions for words. And they're asking you for what the definition means, and then they write it down, and it's fixed. It's there. It's written. And so what this is doing is making the language far more univocal in the way it's conceived. Now, mixed up here. How did this sort of translate into itself? Well, certainly translating the Bible gave Kikuyu many new words. Jesu Christu, that doesn't take much imagination to figure out what word that was. Shaltani, which means Satan, was a word. Murkaya, which means angel, was another word. And there are numerous other words that, and since I don't know Kikuyu and I'm relying on John, I'm just using some of the examples that he gave. But translation also changed meanings, and I'd like to use some of these words to just show you how it translated some of the meanings. Muthamaki meant a leader of the elders, and this was a person who had some very good attributes. He was a consensus maker. He was one who exhibited wisdom, eloquence, tact, self-control, and knowledge of local customs. It was a person who did not have the power to arbitrarily rule over others, but had the ability to find out what the will of the people was and articulate it in such a way that everybody could find could find agreement with whatever he said. So that was really sort of what it meant in Kikuyu before the Bible translators came in. But the Bible translators needed a word to express king, to express emperor, to express, you know, prime minister or president, somebody in a very hierarchical position who was eminent, who had, you know, who had all these powers. And what did they do? They chose this word, and by choosing this word, redefined what power, the power relationships amongst the Kikuyu. Another example, Mbari means kinship. It means sort of a transgenerational structure. You know, you're part of a kinship structure. You have ancestors who are deceased, but you also have, you know, generations living on the earth. And what the Bible translators needed was a word that could express the meaning of a people or a tribe or a nation. And so they used the word Mbari to express that. But that dramatically changes the way in which language is now used to express things. Because, you know, a kinship group does not necessarily mean a people. It certainly does not mean a tribe. And so by simply using it to mean the Kikuyu, they are giving it meanings. They are imposing some sort of, they're imposing a ethnic sort of conception on the people that had not been there before. Murati is another word. In Kikuyu, before the Bible translators gave it its sort of univocal meaning, it meant age groups. Traditionally, you are part of a kinship group, you're part of a sort of a clan, or another little visitor. Chipmunk just ran out of here. You're part of this family group, but you are also allied to people who are going through a process of maturation with you. The culmination is, and it varies from place to place, but the culmination is in all sorts of rites that ally you to people in an age group of usually about 5 to 7 years. And then your position in that society is plotted with this age group. You, from about maybe 14 to 21, your duty is to be warriors. From maybe 21 to 28, your duty is to have families, to procreate. From maybe 28 to 35, well, you're beginning to assume some of the sort of the financial responsibilities of the society. And maybe over 35, since life expectancy was rather short at that time, you then moved with your whole age group into a position of being the decision makers of that group. So that's sort of what it meant before the Bible translators came in. But what the Bible translators needed was a word that would define sort of community, that would define solidarity. So it had nothing to do with age group rights. It had nothing to do with all of these other aspects of it. It just meant a bland sort of community or solidarity. And so they gave it that precision. Now there's all sorts of other examples, and some of them really didn't work. The Bible translators, and this is sort of rather humorous, selected the following word, what do I have? Mukahani, and which they thought would be a good word for priest. But in a region just sort of to the north of them, they found that this word meant fornicator, and so they had to drop it. But this is sort of the problems that these Bible translators were faced with. Well, in any case, how, after the New Testament was complete and the Old Testament was in the process of being completed and then was finally completed and disseminated and sold to the Kikuyu, what was the Kikuyu reaction to it? Certainly, at least according to these African linguists, it was very enthusiastic, and they seemed to have enough evidence to support that depiction. And this enthusiastic reaction came, I think, for maybe a couple reasons, two or three. First, the Kikuyu were sort of impressed that God spoke their own language, finally. So there was an element of sort of self-satisfaction, maybe even pride, hubris, in the fact that, okay, now they had the Bible, God's word, in their own language. Two, it gave the Kikuyu full access to God's word without Western missionaries being the mediators. Now they could read the Bible in its entirety and find out that indeed, in the sermons, in the catechism classes or whatnot, they were only getting the partial story. And with this sort of full availability of the scriptures to them, many of these Kikuyu converts then began to disagree with the missions themselves and create their own churches. A famous one amongst the Kamba is the ABC, the African Brotherhood Church, that is, I think, has grown and has remained vital and is now a charter member of the WCC, the World Council of Churches. So it grew up in this period. But in any case, it also gave the Kikuyu or enabled the Kikuyu to identify more fully with people who had similar cultures and to their own. In other words, they were reading about agrarian cultures of the Middle East and pastoralist cultures. They could relate to many of the stories of the Old Testament, and they thought, you know, there's some affinity here. These aren't these white guys driving around in Model T Fords or Model A Fords. These are people who actually were herders, who were cultivators, who spoke the same language we spoke. Well, what happens, and how does this translation then develop into Kikuyu political consciousness or African political consciousness? The Athomi, who were mission adherents or were converts, were the people most able to use the gift of literacy, the gift of the Old Testament, or the translation of the Old Testament and the New Testament, to promote their political package. And I think Jomo Kenyatta is a very, very good example. He's a real radical. By the 50s, he's implicated in starting Mau Mau, which is this rebellion where violence was used against white settlers. And then, of course, white settlers retaliated against primarily the Kikuyu, and it was a time of civil war, where the atrocities, the human rights abuses, are quite exceptional. But in any case, before becoming radicalized, or before finally sort of in exasperation, employing violence to coax the British to leave Kenya, Jomo Kenyatta started gradually. He started a newspaper. The newspaper, loosely translated, translates into the reconciler or unifier. And what was he doing there? He was going back to the Old Testament and finding out that the Jews often felt oppressed also. And, you know, the oppressors were the Egyptians, the Canaanites, the Hittites, whoever they were. But the Jews felt the sense of oppression. And he thought, oh, there's a parallel with what we are feeling as Kikuyu, as Kenyans, as Africans. And so by utilizing the Old Testament, he was then able to find analogies in to articulate the sense of betrayal, the sense of injustice, the sense of oppression that the Africans were beginning to feel. And furthermore, the Old Testament also gave the Africans vision of a brighter future. It gave them the assurance that God was on the oppressed side. It gave them sort of visions of harmony, of reconciliation, and all of these images are there in his newspaper. Not only he, but almost the whole leadership of Mau Mau, were the whole Kikuyu intelligentsia, were writing in metaphors, using stories, in idioms that were no longer anywhere close to Kikuyu before the translators sort of standardized and formalized Kikuyu, but were essentially using this new lexicon, this new sort of dictionary of meanings to convey to the Kikuyu their sense of tribal solidarity, of tribal consciousness. Now, where are we sort of going? I think tomorrow I'm going to be talking about Ngugi Wa Thong's Matagiri. And this book, I think, exemplifies exactly what we're talking about here. He is a radical Kenyan. He possibly took part in Mau Mau, we're not quite sure. Certainly family members did. One of his most famous books is The Barrel of the Pen, in which he really sort of condemns the whole colonial imperialist enterprise. But then afterwards, after the euphoria of liberation, after Kenyatta became almost a dictator, and certainly Daniel Arap Moi has become a veritable dictator, he has used his pen to begin to articulate liberation against other Africans. But the metaphors, the stories, the way in which he does this is biblical, even though he has no intention of being biblical at all. He identifies himself as being a proponent of African, a believer in African traditional religions, that euphemistically called paganism or animism or whatever. But I think a better way to express it is African traditional religions. He wants to get back to a sense of identity that is truly African. But the way he is expressing it is biblical. And this is what Paul Maloney has talked about, that most of the at least East African intelligentsia are so sort of shaped by the colonial or by the missionary enterprise that the impact is so pervasive that they can't even go beyond the language in which they're using. Well, I just use this as I think one example of the way in which people are now beginning to reassess the impact of the missionary enterprise on Africa. And it's rather, you know, particular in itself. I think there's room to education, to find out what the impact of missions were on education, on social mobility, on commercial enterprises. I mean, there's a whole array of other avenues in which it could go, I think, to more adequately address what the missionary enterprise was. But at least it's a start. So I don't want to drag this on too long, but it seems to me that we're getting out of some of the sort of the paradigmatic blinders that have hindered us from considering what are the impact of missionary enterprise in its sort of totality. And I think I'll stop there and entertain some questions if there are any.
I'm just curious, you talk about language, the missionaries using these words and changing the meaning, you know, to fit the gospel or whatever. It could work the other way around, too. I mean, the words they use, they take the meaning from the gospel and they apply it to their own situation. So you have...
There has been a little bit of analysis of this, especially in the African sort of indigenized churches, where they take some of these words, they for instance, polygamy. Their interpretation of, especially based on the translations, the Old Testament is far more ambiguous about whether to condemn or condone polygamy in their translations because of words than it is in English translations. So you're right. There's two ways it can go. I think especially within a sort of the political sphere, it's much more Western leaning.
Yeah, I'm intrigued by the way in which that language got used in a way that led toward more emphasis on tribal solidarity in a politically effective kind of way. Mm-hmm. Did that also mean that the tribal solidarity was in a way that set them more strongly over and against other tribal groups or other?
Yeah.
Was that also part of it? I mean, and then,
yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Warring kind of direction that contributed to.
Yeah. I mean, we see this in some of the sort of the new analyses of the genocide in Rwanda. Mm-hmm. You know, here in the West, we say it's ethnic. It's Hutu against Tutsi. Well, before the Belgians came in and then followed by the French, you know, there was a lot of sort of, I guess, ethnic miscegenation, an intermixing of these different groups. And since your identity was to your age group, which could span ethnic identity sometimes, or to your kinship group, you really didn't have a conception of a tribal or ethnic identity. Some people did. I'm generalizing. Some areas in Africa they did, but not always. And certainly, it's hard to impose this ethnic notion of clear-cut boundaries between these groups in East Africa. They're sliding this way and that way. But because of, I think, language articulating hierarchical sort of structures with kingpins on top and sort of lines of power lines all the way down the society, and then other words that were retranslated, reconceived to mean that kinship no longer meant, you know, your direct kin, but but those of a certain ethnic group or a certain linguistic group, all of a sudden you get the creation of more you know, defined ideas of ethnicity in Africa, or at least in East Africa. Any other questions?
You mentioned how your family had gone to different mission fields. My youth was spent at the time of the image of the ugly American, not understanding the culture of the area. Is this characteristic of mission endeavors, or is there an effort to come to know the culture and ways of a place and to spend your entire life as a missionary to that place?
My grandparents certainly illustrated that. They went out to India in 1920, somewhere around there. 21? Thanks. My wife's correcting me. They came back, I think, around 1960. They spent virtually their whole adult life out there. Shortly after coming back to the United States, my grandfather passed away. His whole identity, he was a migrant from the Volga-Deutsch region of Russia to Canada, went through seminary in Canada, went directly out to the mission field. His German was great, his English was really quite poor, and his Telugu was fantastic. So he really sort of identified with the Indian culture. I think that notion of spending a career out in a place is breaking away. You just seldom find that kind of a commitment anymore. People spend maybe a maximum of 10 to 12 years in an area and then either leave missions or maybe sometimes move elsewhere. My father was sort of unique because he jumped around in a number of capacities, and primarily because he had a doctorate in Christian education, and then seminaries in these different locales wanted him to develop a Christian education in these different areas. Does that sort of answer your question a little bit? No. But getting back to the ugly American, I think, yeah, I'm sure some missionaries epitomize the ugly American, but not always. I know that in Ethiopia, for example, some of the American missionaries won't ever go up to the 4th of July festival at the embassy. Embassy throws this big celebration for 4th of July for all Americans living in Ethiopia. And they just so disassociate themselves from the embassy, from your typical American, because they live out in the community, they live with Africans, that they don't even want to have an African see them go there and participate in that ceremony.
Since the church in Africa seems to be growing phenomenally, as we're shrinking slowly. Is this the Africans, I'm presuming, are doing most of the evangelizing?
Absolutely.
Well, now, what does that say to us here?
Well, that's what I'm hoping we can talk about on Friday. I hope to open that sort of can of worms on Friday, because I think it says a heck of a lot, and that we should be mindful of gifts. You know, what are gifts? Are they just sort of monetary gifts, or the gift of a person who is specialized in maybe Christian education or something to a seminary? Or are there other gifts that we haven't identified that maybe we could benefit from, that they could give us? And the church in Africa is growing.
Which direction the missionaries be going? Seems like we've got them, we're going in the wrong direction. Well, they seem to know, they seem to have the zeal, they seem to have the ability to touch the hearts of many, many people, and we're losing that ability. We can talk about all the issues, of course, but It just, and numbers, as we say, don't measure everything, but there's something going on.
I mean, one of the exciting things in the Lutheran missionary enterprise now is the idea of South-South missionaries. The Madagascar Church has a surplus of medical missionaries, or a surplus of doctors. And so they are sending them to New Guinea, to Cameroon, to Central African Republic. And I guess these Malagasy doctors are just having an incredible impact on the communities and in which they're living. So you're right. It's sort of all up for grabs. It's a very complex situation, I think, right now, especially as this world becomes this infinitely smaller village that is so transnational. Any other questions? I think I'm stopping a little bit ahead of time, but thank you for coming, and maybe the water's on, and maybe we can actually get a cup of coffee. That's what I'm most anxious to get. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.